So the jhanas are these states, but what is the actual translation of the word jhana? The word jhana means meditation. In Pali it's jhana, in Sanskrit it's jnana with a D, in Chinese it's chan, and in Japanese it's zen, which is quite interesting since I've not found any reference to the jhanas in any Zen teaching. But it means meditation. Sometimes the Buddha would say, after giving a Dharma talk, would say to the monks, "Monks, there are roots of trees, there are empty huts, go meditate." And the word he used is jhana, the verb form of jhana, jayati. Go do jhana. So this was the form of meditation that he taught, or at least one of the forms. In the Satipatthana Sutta, we have other forms of meditation and contemplation. We're still looking at the body, because there's a bunch of practices given for the body in the first foundation, the first establishment of mindfulness. The sixth practice is given is the nine charnel ground contemplations. As I said earlier, charnel ground is where they just dump the bodies of people who couldn't afford a cremation. And if you had too much lust, they would send you to meditate in the charnel ground. And here are the instructions. Again, as if one were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1 or 2 or 3 days dead, bloated, discolored, festering, and compares this body with that, thinking, "This body is of the same nature. It will become like that. It is not exempt from this fate." Again, as if one were to see a corpse in a charnel ground thrown aside, eaten by crows, hawks, or vultures, by dogs or jackals, or various other creatures, and compares this body with that, thinking, "This body is of the same nature. It will become like that. It is not exempt from this fate." Again, as if one were to see a corpse in a charnel ground thrown aside, a skeleton with flesh and blood connected by sinews. A fleshless skeleton smeared with blood connected by sinews. A skeleton detached from flesh and blood connected by sinews. Randomly connected bones scattered in all directions. A hand bone here, a foot bone there, a shin bone here, a thigh bone there, a hip bone here, a spine there, skull there, and compares this body with that. Again, as if one were to see a corpse in a charnel ground thrown aside, the bones whitened looking like shells, the bones piled up a year old, the bones rotted away to a powder, and compares this body with that, thinking, "This body is of the same nature. It will become like that. It is not exempt from that fate." So the idea, of course, is to recognize death, that you have a limited time and you're going to wind up looking like these bodies in various stages of decay in the charnel ground. And since one does each of these practices internally, externally, arising and ceasing, the internal is my body's going to wind up like that, and the external is whoever I'm lusting after is also going to wind up like that. When I was at Wat Suan Mok in southern Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, after the retreat ended, the abbot Ajahn Po offered a tour of the monastery. And so we all gathered at the designated spot. And he says, "Would you like to see a beautiful Thai woman?" We were all a little surprised, this coming from the abbot. We said, "Yes." And so he led us to this building. And he opened the door, and you walk in, and there on the wall are three skeletons. And he points to the middle one, and he says, "Oh, she was so beautiful." Charnel ground meditation. Since we don't have charnel grounds in the West, we can't exactly do this, but it does say, as if one were to see a corpse. So you can do it with your imagination. If you don't have that good of imagination, on the internet, there is a charnel ground. I believe it was a monk who asked that his body be kept and photographed as it decayed and the pictures put on the internet. So if you go to my website and you click on my bookmarks and you look under Buddhism, you can actually find a link to this virtual charnel ground and do your contemplation that way. But you can sometimes do it not with human bodies, but with bodies of animals. If you're hiking in the woods and you find some creature that's died, take a look at it. You know, your body is going to do the same thing as that creature's body. If you're someplace where you go regularly, you might be able to visit this decaying body on multiple occasions and watch what happens. I teach in Washington State at a retreat center called Cloud Mountain. And I was there one year and an elk had died not far from the retreat center, maybe a couple hundred meters. And so I could go out each day that I was there for this month and visit the carcass of the elk and watch it decay over the month. And you could see that it had been eaten and pieces dragged off. I came back 6 months later and went back to see what it looked like. And yeah, wasn't any flesh left. It was just bones. And 6 months after that, the bones weren't whitened. In Washington State, it rains a lot. And so they had a, sort of a green color to them. And then 6 months after that, I had trouble finding the place. The bones were just totally scattered and gone. So sometimes it's possible to do this. In the U.S., they had an exhibition called Body World, where they took corpses and they peeled away various layers and encased what was left in plastic, and you could go and look at people's bodies.
I think it's on at the moment in Vanta, Eureka, Eureka.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably another month.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's... I was actually supposed to visit it, like, just last weekend. Not related to this. But I was ill, so we had to skip it. And I think, like, it's... The weekend after the retreat is the last weekend it's on. So,
okay.
Charnel ground contemplation.
Yeah. So where is this?
It's a science center in north of Helsinki. It's the town that joins Helsinki, really.
Okay, so I could go see it. I've never managed to make it. So I'll be in Helsinki for a few days. So, yeah. Anybody wants to go charnel ground contemplating with me, let me know. So anyhow, that's another possibility. So, questions or comments about this practice?
Coming from a country that I think at that time had 80 million sheep, I found a sheep actually where I used to go and sit on the hill, a place called Monkey Hill, that had just died, and managed to go there for about, I guess, a month or 6 weeks before the carcass was removed anyway. It just happened to be right in front of where I was habitually going to sit anyhow.
Interesting. Yeah, sometimes we do get opportunities to do this practice. It's a rather sobering practice.
I guess there are some. I seem to recall that there's some sort of warning regarding, you know, some people might become a bit too morbid if they practice too much of this.
Yes, this is true. If you have a tendency towards being morbid, then maybe this is not a good practice for you. Yeah. But, yeah, it's interesting practice. Ajahn Sumedho talks about being in Thailand and going to the morgue in Bangkok, because that's what monks would do. And he walks in and the head of the morgue says, oh, so nice to see you. And he's all excited about showing him all the various dead bodies and so forth. So, okay, so I'm not going to require you to do this practice. So that's the practices for mindfulness of the body. The breath, the postures, the daily activities, the parts of the body, and we did the body scan for that, the four elements, and the charnel ground contemplations. The only one of these that was in the original Satipatthana Sutta was the parts of the body. All the others seem to have been added later. So moving on to the second foundation, which is mindfulness of Vedana. Vedana usually is translated as feeling, and it's literally correct, but in English the word feeling also has a connotation of emotions. And the second foundation of mindfulness is not emotions, no matter what you might hear. It's noticing your initial categorization of a sensory input into one of three categories: pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. We don't really have a word in English, I suspect you probably don't in Finnish either, that corresponds to Vedana. I've seen all sorts of phrases used, words attempted to be used, but nothing really captures it. So initial categorization of sensory input is the best that I've come up with so far. This particular practice, this establishment of mindfulness, only has the one practice, and that was one of the original practices as well. So, how does one abide contemplating Vedana as Vedana? Here, feeling a pleasant Vedana, one knows that one is experiencing a pleasant Vedana. Experiencing a painful Vedana, one knows that one is experiencing a painful Vedana. Experiencing a Vedana that is neither painful nor pleasant, one knows that one is experiencing a Vedana which is neither painful nor pleasant. Experiencing a pleasant sensual Vedana, one knows that one is experiencing a pleasant sensual Vedana. Experiencing a pleasant non-sensual Vedana, one knows that one is experiencing a pleasant non-sensual Vedana. Experiencing a painful sensual Vedana, experiencing a painful non-sensual Vedana, experiencing a sensual Vedana that is neither painful nor pleasant, experiencing a non-sensual Vedana that is neither painful nor pleasant, one knows what one is experiencing. Okay, so the three categories, and they are in Pali, Sukha Vedana, Dukkha Vedana, and adukha asukha Vedana, the a meaning not. And then it's further subdivided into sensual and non-sensual. So basically the idea of this practice is to pay attention to your reaction to your sensory input. Do you find it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? This is important because basically we run our lives chasing after pleasant Vedana and running away from unpleasant Vedana and ignoring the ones that are neither. It's almost like we got born, we arrived here, and they gave us an instruction manual, and it says, pursue pleasure, avoid pain, live forever. Well, it turns out it's not the best advice. It is useful at times to experience pleasant Vedana. It's useful at times to avoid the unpleasant Vedana. But this isn't the whole strategy for having a good life. You might have heard the phrase, no pain, no gain. Right? Sometimes you have to do stuff that's somewhat unpleasant in order to have a better life. Sometimes you need to avoid things that are pleasant in order to have a better life. But if you're not paying attention to the Vedana, there's a strong tendency to just simply go for the pleasant ones and run from the unpleasant ones. And so the second foundation of mindfulness is about paying attention to this. One of the reasons it's so important is that we tend to crave the things that are pleasant and crave for the absence of things that are unpleasant. And as you've heard, dukkha arises dependent upon craving. So if you're not paying attention to the Vedana, then it can lead to the craving, and the craving leads to the dukkha. And of course, we're trying to avoid having the dukkha experiences. So this is why the Buddha made this actually very tiny part of our experience so important. The Vedana arise in the old brain, in the reptilian structure. It takes about 1/10 of a second for you to decide this is pleasant or this is unpleasant. Actually, you don't do the deciding. You just experience it as pleasant or unpleasant. The old brain, the reptilian part, is not under your control. It's running on automatic. It's really not possible to change the Vedana, at least for something that's quite simple, a simple input. If I strike the bell, it sounds pleasant. The reason it sounds pleasant is because the ringing of the bell involves multiple overtones, and the ratio of the frequency of those overtones is small whole numbers. They've actually figured out the physics of pleasant Vedana for sounds. If we had a blackboard and I scrape my fingernails down it, it's producing overtones that don't have ratios of small whole numbers, and we experience it as unpleasant. But that's just like a single sound. A piece of music involves remembering what you just heard and anticipating what you'll hear next. It's a much more complex thing. When I first went to Bali, my friend said to me, "Oh, there's going to be a gamelan concert in the next village. We should go." I was like, "Oh, okay." I'd never heard gamelan music, but I'd heard of it, and so we went along and sat down, and they started playing the music, and it was weird. In the West, we have these 8 tones, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right? And the Indonesian gamelan music didn't use that scale. It used something different, and I found it weird for about the first 2 pieces, and then I adjusted to it and found it quite pleasant. Now, when I was finding it weird, each of the sounds that was being made was pleasant, but the relationship between them was unfamiliar, and I was finding it a bit unpleasant until I got used to it. And then I could do the anticipation and so forth based on what I'd heard, and suddenly it was wonderful, and I've really appreciated gamelan music ever since. So there's an example of something that initially was producing unpleasant Vedana, but soon was producing pleasant. It was complex and therefore changeable. That can also happen with taste. Remember all those horrible vegetables you had to eat as a kid that now taste quite wonderful? Right? The tastes are complex, and so it can change over time. Actually, it can change quite quickly. I grew up in Mississippi, and in Mississippi, Coke was king. In fact, Coca-Cola, as we called it, was so prevalent that you would ask somebody, "What kind of Coke you want? You want a Pepsi or a 7-Up or a Coke?" It was the generic term for soft drink. We also had Dr. Pepper. I don't know if you have Dr. Pepper over here. Looks like Coke, doesn't taste like Coke. I didn't like Dr. Pepper because, well, it didn't taste like Coke. The summer after I finished high school, I was working at an agricultural experiment station. It was in weed control for cotton plants. Growing up in Mississippi, there was a lot of cotton being grown at that time. And so My job, along with several other guys, was to go out to the cotton fields where they had applied different weed killers. And there was one guy who had a stopwatch, and he would say, go, and then we would chop down all the weeds in a row of cotton. And when we finished, he'd stop the stopwatch and write it in his clipboard and so forth, so they could tell how many weeds there were by how long it took us to chop them down. It was like between 35 and 40 degrees every day and 80% humidity. Wasn't the most pleasant thing to do, but that was the summer jobs that were available in the area. But sometimes it was necessary to go back to headquarters to take a message to the big boss or something. And that was a really good assignment because, so maybe it was a kilometer walk to headquarters, but headquarters was air conditioned. And better yet, they had a Coke machine, right? So one time I got to take the message to headquarters, and I take it, and quickly to the building and slowly up the stairs and give the message, and then down to where I knew the Coke machine was. I can already taste my Coke. I've got my dime out and nothing but Dr. Pepper. Well, I was so hot and thirsty and wanted something sweet, I put it in and I opened it and it tasted so good. And ever since, I've actually preferred Dr. Pepper over Coke. It went from producing unpleasant Vedana to pleasant Vedana in just one instant there. So Vedana are somewhat changeable, but only if it's complex, and sometimes only over time. Now, it talks about the pleasant sensual Vedana and the pleasant non-sensual Vedana, and the unpleasant sensual and non-sensual, and the neither sensual and non-sensual. The actual Pali word is with flesh or without flesh. And there are a number of interpretations of what that actually means. The construction is not particularly common. One interpretation is that with flesh means the five external senses, and the without flesh means the sixth sense of the mind. Everyone, I'm sure, is aware that the thinking and emoting is considered the sixth sense. And so you have different reactions to what you think. If I start talking about something really sad, it makes you feel bad. That's the unpleasant Vedana that are arising from you thinking about what I'm talking about. The actual sound of my voice might be quite neutral, but what I'm bringing up in your mind produces an unpleasant Vedana. So we want to pay attention to the external Vedana as well as the internal Vedana, what I call the downstream Vedana. When you look at something, often the Vedana you experience are based on your reaction to what you're looking at, the thoughts and emotions that come up based on what you're looking at. Or if you hear something and it's fairly neutral, but it starts a thought train, then your experience is based on the thought train. I saw an article that said that 80% of our mental activity is triggered by internal mental activity, not the external senses. So mostly we're just thinking about stuff inside of our own heads. That's what we're experiencing, and all of that is producing Vedana. So when you look at something, unless it's maybe a sunset or a beautiful scene, you may start thinking about what it is that you're seeing, and the Vedana arises based on that. I remember one student coming to an interview after I talked about Vedana, and she said she was going for a walk and looking for Vedana, just looking at things and watching how the Vedana arose in her mind. And she saw something blue, and the color was pleasant, and then she recognized it was a garbage can, and then the experience was unpleasant. Right? So we often get this mixture. You hear an airplane fly over, the sound of the airplane is not pleasant, but it reminds you that next week you're going to be on holiday in Spain, and you're like, oh yeah, nice sound. But it's the thoughts you're having that are nice rather than the sound itself. Visual Vedana arise based on the colored shapes. So a sunset, yeah, that's colored shapes, and that's, it doesn't have any meaning behind it, really. And so you experience it as pleasant visual Vedana. The house I grew up in had a tile floor in the kitchen, and there were large dark blue squares and small dark orange squares. It was actually quite hideous. Okay, but that was what was in the house when we moved into it. And after we moved in, my mom got up in the morning to fix breakfast, and she had to light the pilot light on the stove. And so she bent over to light the pilot light, and she almost threw up. She thought she was pregnant. And the second morning, same thing happens. And the third morning, she can't get it lit. She's so nauseated. So she goes and wakes up my father and asks him to light it. He goes in there and he bends over to light it, and he almost throws up. And he's not pregnant, he's sure. The colors were so bad that first thing in the morning when you looked at them, they were at different heights. It would literally make you throw up. I quickly learned when I walked into the kitchen to get my breakfast, don't look down. It was just awful. Eventually, they tore out the floor and put in something else. But the Vedana was so bad, it really was upsetting. Another interpretation of the with flesh and without flesh for the Vedana is spiritual Vedana and worldly Vedana. So the with flesh is worldly, so worldly pleasures, and then spiritual pleasures. And the same for unpleasant worldly experiences and unpleasant spiritual experiences. So what are pleasant spiritual experiences? Well, the jhanas, right? They're producing the sukha, which is actually the same word that's used for sukha vedana. Insight. You gain insight, and that's a pleasant experience. You have some better understanding of how the world works, and that's pleasant. So that produces pleasant Vedana. Doing metta can produce pleasant Vedana. Being generous can also produce pleasant Vedana. For unpleasant spiritual experiences, sometimes when you get an insight, it is kind of disturbing. You might have heard the phrase dark night of the soul. This comes from St. John of the Cross, who was a mystic in Spain in the Middle Ages, and who wrote about the dark night of the cross. But dark night of the soul. Sometimes, and this is well described in the literature, you get enough insight that it starts to freak you out. It's most unpleasant. Now, this actually is a useful thing, and it's helpful to have a teacher around who can help you work through it. Because if you keep working with the insights you've gotten that have kind of freaked you out, it can take you to a very deep place and a much deeper understanding of how the world works. If you were to do the charnel ground contemplations, I think you would experience a lot of unpleasant Vedana. But apparently it had positive benefits. Neutral spiritual Vedana, if you're sitting there following your breath, and it's just rather neutral, yeah, that's what's going on. You're experiencing neutral spiritual Vedana. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So another way of looking at the Vedana are those that are just worldly Vedana and those that are spiritual Vedana. And the spiritual can come in any of the three categories as well. Of course, one does this internally, externally, arising and passing. Internally would be your own Vedana. Externally would be someone else's Vedana. Now, if you have the supernormal power of knowing the minds of others, then you can know their Vedana. But sometimes it's pretty easy to tell. If you see somebody put their hand on the stove and then pull it off and go run cold water on it, you can probably guess they're experiencing unpleasant Vedana. You can see pleasant Vedana on the face of a small child eating chocolate. I mean, it's literally spread all over their face. You can definitely tell they're having a good time with it. So sometimes you can tell what the Vedana is for somebody else without having the any supernormal powers. And then the arising and passing. How long does a Vedana stay around? When you're eating, pay attention to the pleasant and unpleasant aspects of eating. When it's pleasant, how long is it pleasant? I mean, when you had the chocolate the other night, did you get 10 minutes of pleasure out of that? Did you get even a minute of pleasure out of it? 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds? And yet, we spend our lives running after these Vedana, which are so short-lived. Quite interesting, these human beings. So, as I said, this is a very important aspect, though, of being mindful of the Vedana, of recognizing the Vedana that you're experiencing. Because if you're not mindful, then it can often lead to craving. And as we know, craving can lead to dukkha. Thank you.